All right, our next case is 11-52, Artisan Mechanical Incorporated versus James Michael Beezer et al. For the appellant is Mr. Pepper.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, my name is Tim Pepper. I'm counsel for the appellant, Artisan Mechanical. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The question certified by this court for argument today really presents a balancing question of two competing public interests. The first public interest, would be the interest in enforcing settlement agreements. This court has a plethora of precedent, and the courts below do as well, holding that settlement agreements are favored in the law, negotiated resolutions to litigation are favored, and if one is reached, then it should be enforced, and that things that occur after the settlement, second-guessing or whatnot, should not obviate the fact that a settlement did occur.
So, counsel, based on the record, you are relying on an oral agreement as opposed to a signed document. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct. We are relying upon the mainly upon the emails that were exchanged between counsel where an offer was expressly accepted and opposing counsel expressly wrote, "We have a deal."
But there was no signed document, correct?
The parties never signed a document entitled settlement agreement. No,
well, the appellees signed the document. Your client did not sign the document. And why are the appellees not allowed to rely on the fact that there is no settlement? There were several emails requesting, weren't there, that the document be executed by your client?
Well, our position is that the settlement agreement was reached at the email stage when counsel for both parties discussed the terms and communicated to each other that a deal had been struck.
Oh, you want us to create law that says a settlement agreement is not required to be signed as long as there are emails showing that there's a meeting of the minds.
Well, I don't think that's creating law. I think that's well-established law that it doesn't require a document that says at the top settlement agreement, signed at the bottom, or if there to be a settlement agreement. In fact, this court has a lot of precedent that oral settlement agreements that don't even get reduced to writing in any way.
But you just said you're not arguing it as an oral contract, you're arguing it as a written contract via the emails.
That's correct. My point about the oral agreement was that, this court has held that even oral agreements to settle can be enforceable. So certainly one that's documented via email where the counsel for the parties expressly state, we have a deal, we accept, certainly those are enforceable at the time that those communications occur.
Counsel, I thought what you, I'm sure, almost reading your item that you're appealing on is whether it's oral, an email, or written and signed by all parties and their lawyers and notary seals on it, whatever it is. I thought your argument was if there's a dispute as to whether or not there was a settlement of a case, that the judge has to have an evidentiary hearing on that dispute.
That is exactly what the issue is before the court. We're arguing the answer is yes.
So the form of the agreement is not what we're arguing about here. You're arguing that if one party says we had an agreement and the other party said we didn't, the judge must have an evidentiary hearing to determine that matter and cannot determine it without an evidentiary hearing.
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly it.
The evidentiary hearing always have to be oral, or can it be submitted on all the briefs and the affidavits?
Well, having a hearing, I think, in the ordinary usage of the term implies an in-court proceeding where witnesses are heard rather than a submission on paper. When we submit summary judgments, for example, we don't typically refer to that as we're having a hearing on summary judgment. We just
Mr. Pepper, isn't this like just ordinary summary judgment? I was having difficulty seeing why a settlement agreement case is any different. I mean, here you have material issues of fact when you're talking about dispute over the existence of a settlement agreement. So why don't we just look at the ordinary Rule 56 and deal with it from that perspective, as the dissenting judge, I think, did?
Well, I believe the answer to that is that this court, in its ruling decision, has previously announced that there is a strong public interest in taking care and precision when enforcing settlement agreements, because they do close the door to the courthouse for one party. And so in the ruling decision, the syllabus is not written in terms of a granting or denying a motion to enforce. The syllabus and ruling flat out says if there is a dispute, the court is required to have a hearing. I would submit that settlement agreements and the enforceability of them are a little bit different than just regular contracts that might be disposed of via summary judgment. And the court's decision and ruling is the authority for that. In that case, the court's syllabus, as I said, doesn't distinguish between who is being awarded relief. It flat out says if there is a dispute as to the existence or the meaning of the terms, the court shall hold a hearing on it. I think the reason for that is because settlement agreements are not your average ordinary contract. They close the door to litigation to one party. They are arrived at in the context of a public policy that heavily favors the enforceability of settlement agreements. So for those reasons, I believe the proper rule of law is the rule of law announced in Ruley, which is that a hearing should be held. All we're really asking the court to do today is to say that its syllabus and Ruley means exactly what it says. We're not asking the court to change one word of Ruley. We're asking the court to hold that Ruley means what it says. If there's a dispute, a real dispute, as in this case, if there's a real dispute, court should hold an evidentiary hearing.
Counsel, would that be on the request of one of the parties? Or is you're asking us to tell the trial courts that every time there's a dispute on whether there's a settlement, that they sui sponte have to schedule an evidentiary hearing?
Well, I believe the question is premised on the counsel's argument that there was a waiver here because there wasn't an express request made for an evidentiary hearing in the trial court level. You know, our response to that is the action to enforce the settlement agreement was a separate lawsuit. It was a breach of contract lawsuit filed by Artisan Mechanical against the defendants. By definition, if you're a plaintiff, if you're filing a complaint alleging that there was a contract that was breached, you're looking for some kind of hearing on the resolution of that. If there's a motion filed that would dispose of that on the merits, of course you want a hearing on that.
So, well, lots of suits are filed in which there are may or may not be disputed facts, but there's a claim made, and then there's discovery, and then there's motions filed for summary judgment, and courts don't always schedule evidentiary hearings on that unless there's something that warrants it or there's a request made for it. And I just, why would this case be different if there isn't a specific request for an evidentiary hearing? That's my question.
I think this case is different because just by its act of filing a complaint and alleging that there was a contract that had been breached, Artisan was making a request for a hearing before the case is dismissed. I think that just because the defendants file a motion for summary judgment doesn't obviate the fact that by filing suit, Artisan was seeking resolution on the merits. Artisan didn't move for summary judgment. Artisan wasn't asking the court to dismiss it without a hearing in its favor or against it, obviously. Our position would be just by its procedural posture, of course Artisan wants there to be an evidentiary hearing on whether or not there was a contract, whether it was breached, what the damages were. So I don't think that the lack of a specific request to the trial court, hey, let's have an evidentiary hearing on this, I don't believe that should be dispositive of this case. And on top of that, with all due respect to the trial court, this case is replete with questions of fact on whether or not there was an agreement. What are the terms? Are the terms reflected in those emails, or are the terms reflected in the subsequent document that was signed by half of the parties?
Didn't your client tell the court the case is settled?
I told the court the case was settled.
And don't you represent Artisan?
I do.
So what would the court think when it receives a communication from you on behalf of your client saying the case is settled, other than you've reached an agreement.
Well, it's exactly right. And I told the court that because
well,
we
isn't
had
the court justified in suggesting that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't catch
isn't the court justified in relying on that? On your representation?
Yes, it is. And in the dismissal
and when it
entry,
finds that you haven't then signed an agreement, but the other party has, what is the court to do?
Let me back up a second on the procedure here.
All right.
The agreement is reached via email between myself and opposing counsel. We then, there was a court date of some kind, I forget what it was, coming up right away. I called the court, told the court we've reached an agreement. Things were canceled. Depositions were canceled. Further case management events were canceled. The court put on the order of dismissal that is in the record, pursuant to my call with the court. And the order of dismissal says, court's been advised by the parties that the above action has been settled. Action is dismissed with prejudice, provided that any of the parties may, upon good cause shown within 60 days, request further court action if settlement's not consummated. Upon agreement, within 60 days, the parties may.
What was
may.
That? Unless it was not consummated?
Was not consummated.
All right.
So what that phrase not consummated means
is that one of the parties didn't sign the agreement.
Or no, it could also, well, it might mean that. The judge isn't here, we don't know. It could also mean if the agreement to settle was not performed. The court didn't know what the terms were. For all the court knew, someone's going to write someone else a check, and if the check never arrives, okay, the deal is not consummated, we'll reopen the case.
Okay.
And so then the court goes on to write, upon agreement, not required, but if the parties agree to, the parties may submit a supplementary entry outlining the details of the settlement. The court issued this order based on my call to the court saying we have a deal. This order clearly demonstrates the court's belief that there was a deal in place.
All right.
Other side never objected to this order. Other side never got this and said, whoa, hold on, there's no settlement agreement. No. Parties dropped the case after this order was issued. There were subsequent discussions, the record is clear about that, about what a written agreement might look like. That written agreement was not a condition to the settlement. In the record, the court will find emails between counsel where opposing counsel says, yeah, I might suggest that we produce a settlement agreement. Doesn't say this is conditioned upon that, we have to do that, there's no deal if we don't. In fact, it says the exact opposite. We accept, quote unquote. We have a deal, quote unquote.
Counsel, I'm back to your proposition a lot, the front end of your brief, and listening to the interplay here back and forth. I'm wondering about all of those situations where at pretrial or at trial, there's a headbanging, and then there's a conclusion. This case, in the best interest of your client and the best interest of the other side's client, needs to be settled, and you discuss some terms, and you say to the judge, we've settled this case, and you may sometimes disclose the terms, and you may not disclose the terms. But let's say you disclose in some detail in the judge's office, and we settled this case, the judge is curious, and you tell him all about it, and then something blows up. You think the judge has to have an evidentiary hearing on that to dispose of that case? Because your proposition law is pretty sweeping, and it strikes me in listening to this that we're down to a factual dispute in one case, and you may have a good argument that the judge should have taken some testimony in your case, but that's all it is. It's about your case and whether or not he should or shouldn't have taken some evidence in your case before it concluded the matter.
Well, we are not arguing for a bright line test that anytime anyone comes to court and says there's a dispute, that there automatically has to be a hearing, right?
Let me read what you told us. When the meaning of the terms of the settlement agreement is disputed, or where there is a dispute that contests the existence of a settlement agreement, a trial court must conduct an evidentiary hearing before entering judgment.
Yeah, I concede that a more artfully worded proposition of law would be if there's a good faith dispute over the existence of a settlement agreement. If there is an actual dispute, I think those qualifiers are important. They should be in there. But on the facts of this case, if the court is not going to adopt a bright line rule and instead just rule on the facts of this case, it's clearly a dispute in this case as to whether or not there was a settlement agreement.
Well, then that's error correction on our part, is it not? If there's no sweeping law to be made here, then you're asking us to rethink what happened below and just correct an error.
Well, the error below, in our view, was that the court, when faced with a legitimate good faith dispute over the existence of the agreement, the court did not hold a hearing. The court issued summary judgment for one side. That is the error below that we think this court should correct. We're not asking this court to jump in and decide the outcome below. We're asking this court to hold that on these facts, a hearing was necessary.
When there's a good faith dispute as to the existence of a settlement agreement, there has to be a hearing in the trial court. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the holding in ruling. That's actually the syllabus in ruling. Like I said a minute ago, we're not asking the court to change a word of the syllabus of ruling. We're asking the court
Okay, then if you're not asking us to make any new law, case law, and you're only asking us to apply ruling, correct?
I'm asking this court to apply Ruley to a set of facts different from the facts that presented itself in Ruley.
Is that not still error correction?
Well, in the sense that it would lead to a reversal of the Court of Appeals, then yes.
Except we do have a conflict here. We do have a conflict issue. We have two courts that hold otherwise, don't we?
Right. You have two other courts that hold that the Ruley does not require a hearing under these facts, which is a certified conflict before the court. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
Mr. Cavada?
Thank you, Madam. May it please the court, Mr. Pepper. My name is Anthony Cavada. I represent James Michael Beiser and Christopher Lay.
Counsel, before you start, let me ask a question. Yes. Are there any facts in dispute in this case?
No, Your Honor. There are no facts in dispute, and that's why summary judgment was granted by the trial court and upheld by the Court of Appeals.
Would an evidentiary hearing have produced any facts in dispute?
All the evidence was before the trial court. There is no evidence. There was no 56F motion asserted to ask for additional discovery to present evidence. There has never been. The entire case was before the trial court.
What do you read the rule in Ruley to say? What is your understanding of what Ruley requires?
I believe that Ruley requires, when there is a good faith dispute about the viability of a settlement agreement, that the court must hold an evidentiary hearing before it enforces a settlement agreement.
I think that's. How does the court know whether it's going to enforce a settlement agreement or not? Does it look at the evidence and say, oh, I don't think I'm going to enforce this because I don't really have all the evidence, or I don't believe the evidence, or I don't think it's merit, and then say, because I'm not going to enforce it, I don't have to have a hearing. But if the court's inclined to enforce it, the court says, well, I have to have a hearing under Ruley. What's the process the court uses to even make the decision whether to have the hearing or not?
I think the court does what this court has focused on in two of the other cases before it today. It looks at the trial court. This court expects the trial court judges of the state of Ohio to exercise their discretion, as to what methods and procedures they are going to assert. Justice O'Donnell said in the second case that was before us, the Flynn versus Fairview case, the role of this court is to give the trial court guidance as how to handle certain situations and to give the courts of appeals standards for review.
So if the trial court says, even though one side is claiming, they're obviously claiming their issues of fact,
because you wouldn't have this dispute if they didn't claim their issues of fact. Does the court have the power on its own to say, no, these really aren't issues of fact, and grant summary judgment without a hearing if they're not going to enforce it? And then if the court thinks there might be issues of fact, then they have to hold the hearing under Rooley?
I believe that if I can try to answer Your Honor's question this way, I'm not avoiding the question.
That's right. I'll ask it again if I think you are.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I believe that to read Rooley the way my opponent wants it read is to abrogate the rules of civil procedure as to Rule 56 and as to Rule 60B, and is to vitiate the trial court's discretion to read Rooley that way. Before we get to Rooley, the syllabus of Rooley, which says when there's a legitimate dispute of fact, you know, the court shall hold an evidentiary hearing before entering judgment, the trial court is not shorn of its discretion. The trial court maintains its discretion, not as the court seems to be implying in its question, and I know you're, you know, phrasing it that way on purpose, to blithely say, well, you know, we're not going to have a dispute here today, you know. No. What the court does is it very properly and very seriously looks at what is before it and determines whether there is a legitimate issue, whether there is a legitimate issue as to the settlement.
Okay, then if that's the case, the judge looks at it and says, there's really an issue of fact here. I'm inclined not to grant summary, but I think there's an issue of fact. The court has to, under Rooley, have a hearing?
I think if the court found
it's not really whether it's going to enforce it or deny it. The focus of Rooley is on whether there's a really good faith belief that there's an issue of fact. Is that really the focus? And then the court should have a hearing whether it's going to enforce or deny if it believes there's a good faith dispute?
No. I don't agree with that, because I think that if we interpose summary judgment, which under Rule 1 we're going to do in this case and every other case, if summary judgment is viable, you're never going to get to the issue of probably of denial if summary judgment is granted. So I don't think that this is a proper conflict case. I don't think that there is a conflict. The two cases that are allegedly conflicts both had to do with the enforceability. They both had to do with the presentation, to follow up on Justice Cupp's question, with the presentation of factual material, that there were two schools of thought as to whether there was a settlement agreement. To go back to Justice Pfeiffer's first question, you know, we really have the question here, because of the way this case was put together, as to whether an oral settlement agreement, quote unquote, allegation of an oral settlement agreement, you know, was enforceable. There was no written settlement agreement in this case.
So is the case over or not? The case below?
Yes, and the time for appeal had run.
All right, it's over because there was a statement made to the court that this is settled with prejudice.
Correct.
But it wasn't settled.
There were 60 days. There were 60 days within which that the court gave us within which to supplement the bare bones dismissal entry. I pursued my learned opponent vigorously throughout that 60-day period. I am the one who initiated every attempt to arrive at the settlement. I'm the one who initiated getting my boys to sign a copy of it. After that was not returned to me, during another email, I said, get your guys to sign it, and then my guys will sign it.
And again, what was the reason for the delay?
I'll never know.
All right, so you're saying because the 60 days elapsed, did you stop at that point and say, okay, I don't need to even get a written, it's over, it's done. I need to exercise no more effort here.
What was I supposed to do, Your Honor?
I don't know, I'm asking you, is that what you?
I determined that the other side was not interested in consummating the settlement because they were unwilling to sign the document that.
So your position was the case is over, they're precluded from going after my clients for the non-compete or the issue of poaching clients. So your clients went ahead with their activity with the clients that are in dispute?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Because there was no written agreement, because in my mind, in my good faith belief was that given the refusal of the other side to sign the agreement.
And you did not go back to the trial court during the 60 days and say, hey, we really don't have an agreement, the case is still active? Or did you consider it that their duty because they were pursuing you?
In my too many years before the bar of the state of Ohio, this is the only time that I have not been able to arrive at a settlement, a written settlement agreement under such facts and circumstances. And I was confident up until the 60th day that I would get a signed agreement back because Mr. Pepper and I had worked so hard on it and had exchanged drafts and had talked about it and exchanged terms. So yeah, it's never happened to me before or since. So I was confident that there was no settlement agreement because throughout my experience, the other, you know, over all these years, we'd always been able to get it done. I could only believe one thing, that they didn't want to settle. They didn't want to sign the thing.
Isn't one of the disputed facts whether or not the settlement was conditioned upon a written agreement? Because settlements, oral settlements, are arrived at all the time, which are enforceable by courts.
I said in the same email where we have a deal, you know, I said we should have a written settlement agreement. I'll prepare one and I'll send it to you. I prepared one, I sent it to him. Silence. Weeks later, you know, I call. Where's the settlement?
So the tender of the written settlement is, in your mind, negates the reliance on an oral settlement.
Absolutely, Your Honor. You put that better than I did. Absolutely. Yes. It negated it. It was clear from the record that I wanted as a condition of the
settlement. You don't need a belts and suspenders approach to the settlement here. You've got an oral agreement, but just to make sure we have an oral agreement, let me reduce it to writing. You say,
Your Honor,
one or the other.
Your Honor, we had people who were fussing, feuding, and fighting. I wanted a written settlement agreement. Mr. Pepper says in one of his pleadings where he wanted me to drop the confidentiality provision and the non-disparagement provision, he said, you better drop these. They're going to be more trouble than they're worth. So there was still bad feeling. There was still a problem. So we never got to the point where we could elicit something from the artisan folks, not Mr. Pepper, but from the artisan folks saying, yeah, we agree that there's a settlement. You know, I mean, there was no settlement.
Your impression was you had an agreement. Mr. Pepper's impression was you had an agreement, and then over time you formed the impression that Mr. Pepper could not get his clients to put their signature on the memorialization of the agreement.
That's correct. That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Pepper and I arrived at a notion between the two of us that there was an agreement, but as we went on and tried to reduce that to writing, it became clear to me that of the two attorneys and the two litigants, there were three who were interested in consummating the settlement. There was one that was not.
So, Mr. Cavada, in your view, does Rooley change the operation of Rule 56 with respect to the settlement agreements?
Absolutely not. The rules are paramount, Your Honor.
So when there was the second case and your clients were the defendants with respect to this enforcement of a settlement, you're saying that the court had everything in front of it under Rule 56 to make a judgment in favor of your clients?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And once the summary judgment motion was filed, had my opponent wished, he clearly could have filed a motion under 56F to supplement the record with additional evidence to tell the court specifically what discovery he needed, to elicit testimony from the folks at Artisan or whatever to determine that.
And you're saying that under 56, there were no material issues of fact in dispute. That's your position.
That's what the trial court found, and that's what the court...
No, but I mean, you're saying that there was no dispute as to the material facts before the court.
Your Honor, that's absolutely correct, because the only evidence before the court was the emails, the email chain. And the email chains, I submit, did not show that there was agreement, because there was a refusal on the part of one party to effectuate the settlement, to consummate it, by what's time-honored tradition in the state of Ohio and everywhere else, you know, that if you've got a deal and you try to reduce it to writing and one party refuses to sign it, what else can you expect?
And you say Rooley would not apply in this case because the court had a good faith belief that there was not a legitimate dispute.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The court properly exercised its discretion, which is not taken away from it by Ruley, in any circumstance.
So your issue is not that Ruley doesn't apply if you're not going to enforce, and it only applies if you're going to enforce. Ruley really speaks to the good faith issue that the judge needs to have the hearing.
I think that's a good way to phrase it. I think that's what Ruley means, is that the language, if the court wants to go beyond the syllabus, and I know what the syllabus of Ruley says, but get to it. What this court seemed to be saying in Ruley was, if you're going to enforce a settlement, if you're going to enter judgment, and I went back and looked, I mean, I won't try to educate this court on what entering judgment means, but not 98% of the time entering judgment means that you order people to do certain things. And this court has said, well, then if you're going to order people to do certain things, you ought to be careful about what it is that you're ordering them to do. You're not going to make an agreement for people. You're going to elicit from them what their agreement is and then say, all right, that is your agreement. That's your deal. That's what you're going to go forward with because that is the deal that you made. You're not going to make it up for them. You're not going to make the contract for them.
So you're telling us there's no conflict here?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that there is. I don't think we reach it, and I think that this particular appeal should be dismissed on that basis. And certainly, there's no error to correct because the trial court very properly entered summary judgment on behalf of my clients, and the Court of Appeals properly upheld it. Okay. I think that really kind of covers what I had to say.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Pepper, you've used all of your time. You can have a minute to sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, in any other context, if we had the emails that we had in this case, clearly terms being discussed, one party clearly saying, we have a deal, we accept, there would be no requirement that there be some follow-up piece of paper afterwards or else the deal never existed. This case is no different. The settlement occurred, the contract was reached after those emails were exchanged.
And why have the follow-up with a written agreement signed by the parties and submitted to you? What was the purpose of that?
Well, I think that would be a good topic for an evidentiary hearing. We'd find out what the purpose of that was. From my own point of view, I have done that in the past. We almost did that here because emails, even though they may strike at the heart of the deal, they may have all the material terms, they may contain all that's needed to have an enforceable agreement, it's not the same thing as having the full-out agreement that has the all the other bells and whistles that go along with a settlement
agreement. Emails are not equivalent to an agreement.
They're not verbatim equivalent. The emails in this case clearly contain the material terms of the deal. But when you can have the material terms of the deal agreed upon in writing, as we do here, and still not have all the bells and whistles that you might want to have in some other document. That doesn't mean that it was not an agreement reached by the emails. It just means that there was a stab taken at producing a longer document that was not successful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, we will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.